that's one of the things about religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Hive Mind, and to all the beautiful and wonderful people that are listening and tuning into this podcast. I am your host, Brandon Martin, and welcome to the 37th Cubbyhole Podcast, where important topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. Today is January 30th, 2021. Please make sure to check out all of our previous episodes and other content at the Cubbyhole website. That is CubbyHole.com. So today, we are going to be continuing on with the methods of manipulation that I started last year, and we've been progressively working through the list. There will be slides available for this episode at the Cubbyhole website on the podcast page. All of us here at the Cubbyhole Network would very much appreciate that more people share the information that we are dedicating our lives to sharing with you. We know that a lot of people are not just going to run across the Cubbyhole randomly, so we would really like it to see a bit more movement, and not just for the Cubbyhole, for all the great teachers out there and all their work. You need to share it as much as possible and preserve that information. I recommend for people who are worried about EMP attacks to get Faraday bags. I mean, I know a lot of people that have the Faraday wallets that protect their credit cards from being robbed and being hacked and infiltrated by external sources. But they won't do that for this information, and that's just ridiculous. It shows what they put value on, which is money over top of true scientific knowledge. And they don't really realize like how at jeopardy this knowledge is becoming each and every day. This is very relevant at this time in our history. All we have to do is take a look at how much censorship across all the media platforms is taking place, and we know how crucial it is to preserve this knowledge for posterity and progeny. We are going to be picking up with the method of manipulation known as religion, one of the most powerful methods of mind control that has ever existed. It is very crucial to understand and distinguish the difference between a dogmatic religious belief system or institutionalized religions with the concept of a true hierarchical stepwise progression into the mystery traditions such as natural law and morality. I think Stoicism and Gnosticism are very good examples of this. Even though they both have ultimately failed in their task, we still should take heed, and it would be wise for us to behoof the wisdom that has come from them. The reason why I bring this up is to make it clear that within religion, there is always a core of truth. We must not throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to this. But religious belief systems and institutionalized religion is one of the main enemies that we together are battling against every day. We're going to be speaking more on astrotheology, specifically pertaining to the solar cult doctrine. Now, I want to make it clear also that everything that I am bringing to the table here is simply scratching the surface of this amazing knowledge. We each have to do our own due diligence into understanding this knowledge and really gain a vast variety of eclectic material through comparative research to really start to understand how important this topic truly is. Not only that, but it is also important that once we have that understanding, that we apply it in some way or fashion to dismantle the dogma and to bring to the surface the truth that religion does hold. We are trying to get away from all the garbage. We are trying to peel back the shell of the exoteric doctrines that covertly conceal the truth underneath the dogma. I mean, to me, what religion has done to people is literally remove their frontal lobe and thrown it in a garbage disposal. The more we literalize the Bible, the less we truly understand its esoteric meaning. We have to take a much more holistic approach to find the root of the religious belief systems and trace it back into our history by following the ideas, because ultimately, all religions are based upon astrotheology. As I was explaining in my previous solo episode, the archetypal figure known as Jesus was an aspect, or what I would refer to is an aspect of our consciousness that we must raise out of the darkness and into the light. Or we could say to resurrect ourselves out of the coffin and into the light of truth, love, and freedom. The way that I look at heaven is it is a state of consciousness that must be manifested into the physical domain. The entire concept of heaven and hell is a Hegelian dialectical manipulation that relies solely upon fear and belief rather than a science of natural law to ensure that people behave in accordance with the arbitrary notions of those who are writing those laws. When we are speaking about religion, what we are truly speaking about is who gets to be God's deputies on earth, like Douglas says at the beginning of the episode. We are speaking about law, and law in a proxy form. We are speaking about authority. From my research, I have found that the title Christ is given to those who have reached a certain degree in consciousness, or in fact, a certain degree within the mystery traditions. So we could say that if Jesus was a real person, he must have been initiated into the mystery traditions of ancient Egypt. And whether or not he was initiated into the lower or higher mysteries is still up for debate. I would say that he was only initiated into the higher mysteries. And now, don't get confused with the terminology there about the mysteries. The higher mysteries deal with the solar doctrine far more than they deal with the stellar doctrine. So the lesser mysteries does not mean they are less valuable. Actually, the lesser mysteries are far more relevant and far more important. The higher mysteries is what takes us into Neoplatonism. I'm not going to completely explain that here, but we do need to understand that the lesser or the earlier mysteries are considered to be the purest form of the stellar mythos. So I just wanted to clarify that. But I believe that the title Christ is actually given to people who have been initiated into the mystery schools and have reached a certain degree or level in consciousness. This is what it means to have Christ consciousness, meaning that we all can be at that level of Christ. and this is activated through the heart-based consciousness. So these become synonymous with each other. This also has to do with the rising of the Kundalini energy. Now, the name Jesus actually comes from Yehoshua. This is also related to the name Joshua as well. In Hebrew, it is broken down into five parts, which is Yod, He, Shin, Vav, He. This also relates back to the five alchemical elements. Now, this gets simplified later on down to only four elements, and I find that highly intriguing and very important because it's a reduction in the symbolism and it's a reduction in the mythos and the knowledge. The name Yehoshua became very popular with the Renaissance occultists, specifically in the second half of the 16th century. It is important to understand that when Yehoshua negates the letter Shin from the name, it is a tetragrammaton, whereas when it is added in, it is a pentagrammaton, which correlates to the pentagonal symbolism. The tetragrammaton literally takes out the idea of spirit and puts us all in materialism. The name Jesus is interesting as well, because this is where we get our word yes from. And it correlates to our gesture of yes as well, being up and down movement with our head. Yes is jes, or juice. And this has a correlation to our word yeah, or yah. And this also correlates to the word year, which puts more emphasis on the solar cult doctrine. So now we're going to take a look at parallels between the Egyptian deity Horus in the solar doctrine compared to Yehoshua or Jesus. So we're going to take a look at the parallels within the story to show how we can correlate these to many different traditions and many different deities of the ancient world. This is just one example of thousands upon thousands of examples that could be given. So we have the parallel of the conception between Jesus and Horus, which is by a virgin birth. We have the father parallel. Horus, the only begotten son of God Osiris. We have the parallel to Horus's mother, which is Mary. And if you think back to when I was speaking about maritime admiralty law, we can understand the symbolic correlation to Mary being the water. And we also have Mary, who is Jesus' mother. We have the foster father of Horus, which is Seb. And this correlates to Joseph. The way that this correlates to Joseph is with Seb being broken into Joseph. The B and the PH become phonetically derived from each other and are connected. We have the foster father's ancestry, which is of royal descent for both of them. We have the birth location, which is in a cave for Horus, or in a cave or stable for Jesus. We have the Annunciation by an angel to Isis, his mother, by an angel to Mary, his mother. Horus had 12 disciples. Jesus had 12 disciples. Horus was known to walk on water, cast out demons, heal the sick, restore sight to the blind. This is also known in the Jesus allegory. So as we can see, there are tons of correlations, and I mean, I could go down this list infinitely. I can give some sources for people to look into these things. I would recommend the book, The Christ Conspiracy, The Jesus Mysteries, anything from Gerald Massey, the renowned Egyptologist, the book Sun Gods, and I would also recommend the documentary Zeitgeist for a great introduction to this. In the last episode, episode 32 that I did, we were speaking about astrotheology and how it pertains to religion and mind control and the institutions that are manipulating consciousness at a mass level. There is one correction that I would like to make and make a little point about this. In my last episode, I had mentioned the precession of the equinox, and I had told you guys that it goes counterclockwise, which is correct. But then I started to move clockwise through my examples of that precession. So I just wanted to make it clear that we're moving counterclockwise. That's why it's called a precession. And we are now entering, or have entered, depending on, you know, where you get your sources of information. Some people say we're not entering into this age yet. Other people say that we've already entered into the age of Aquarius now. I personally stick with the idea that we have already entered into the age of Aquarius, but I can get behind that we do have ambiguity in our timekeeping records. And the main way that we can find out whether this is true or not is just by keeping track of the constellations. So from my studies into the constellations, yes, we have moved into the age of Aquarius. We spoke upon the Egyptian mythology being correlated with the astrotheological progression of the sun from the vernal equinox into the autumnal equinox. And I believe that's how you pronounce that, but it's just the autumn equinox. The equinox during September. Another name for the precession of the equinox is also called the Platonic year. And as a brief re-mention here, the best way to remember how long the precession takes place is just by thinking of it in a rounded estimate of 24,000 years. Now, it is more accurate to say it is more around 25,000 years to 26,000 years, maybe a little bit more or a little bit less when it comes to those numbers. It does change. This is not an absolute number. But to generalize this makes it easier to understand and to really correlate to why we have the solar calendars the way that we do, and why do we have the time on the clock the way that we do. There's a lot to this, and you can correlate this to a lot of different solar aspects in our lives, because our entire world is run by a solar cult doctrine, and that's what we're trying to explain here. At least that's what I am trying to explain here by bringing up this form of manipulation. And yes, there are positive attributes to the solar cult. So I'm not trying to marginalize the positive traits and aspects of the solar cult. But we do need to realize the negative aspects. We need a process of negation, a apophatic deduction to understand why we are living in such a world filled with suffering. And one of those main reasons, from my point of view, is because we've allowed the dark solar cult, if we want to give emphasis through a different name, the dark solar cult, power to reign over this world through institutionalized religious belief systems that have not been dealt with by educated people. And one reason for that is because most of us are not very well educated people. We think that memorization of something means that we have understanding of that thing. And this is why IQ tests are very lacking when it comes to actually gauging somebody's true intelligence. Not only does it lack the moral testing or ethical testing, but it also lacks the testing for true understanding, which is very difficult to test, but it can be tested properly. But it is called a precession because the sun moves in retrograde motion through each house of the zodiac counterclockwise. And this consists of movements in 30 degrees. It moves 1 degree backwards every 72 years. One of the main reasons why we get this precession is because the sun's retrograde motion is based upon the Earth's wobble as it orbits the sun. The Earth's wobble is why different constellations appear in different places in the night sky. The sun also appears to be in motion in the galaxy, likely due to the gravitational pull on it from other spatial objects. Now, to give a little bit of history to where we get this precession of the equinox. Now, from my point of view, it obviously dates back far, far into our antiquity that goes well into the stellar cult and probably very early stellar cult. But what is credited as the historical point when we first discovered this sacred movement of the celestial bodies and constellations, it was done by the Greek astronomer, and his name is Hipparchus. And this took place around 170 BCE. But like I said, this was obviously known by the more ancient astronomers of ancient Egypt because they do have this science preserved. The problem is that the Greeks did not understand how to read the ancient Egyptian sign language. So what they did is they just took what they could understand, and everything else they pretty much left behind, or they, you know, reimagined it in their own image. We don't have the full tapestry of the ancient Egyptian sciences where all this is rooted and has been preserved for hundreds of thousands of years, longer than what most people perceive it has been. So what I would call this is a rediscovery of the precession of the equinox. Now, by his calculations, the Piscean Age would end and the Age of Aquarius would begin at around 2040. And at this point, Aquarius will be behind the sun at the vernal equinox, not Pisces. Like I said, we're moving counterclockwise through this process and this cycle. Before this, we given rise to the Aryan Age, and about 2,000 to 2,200 years before that, we were in the Age of Taurus, the bull. And we can see this in some biblical examples, such as Cain slew his brother Abel. Each brother was betrothed to a twin sister. Thus, the death of Abel symbolically ended with the Age of Gemini. Albert Pike describes the reverence of the Persians felt for Taurus. So it's very important. So a good example of this would be check out the movie 300, and Xerxes, the king of the Persians, he has the two golden bowls on his throne when he marches in to conquer the land. And this is symbolic astronomically of the changing of the zodiacal symbols. In Zoroaster's cave of initiation, the sun and the planets were represented overhead in gems and gold. Also, the zodiac. This is, you know, a symbol of the zodiac. So we need to understand how these symbolic references work. The sun appeared emerging from the back of Taurus in the constellation of the bull. In the constellation of the bull, we also find the seven sisters, which is known as Pleiades. Now, Pleiades is associated with the southern polar constellations. And I find that very interesting because we talk about the seven quite a bit here, more specifically the northern polar constellations. But in some of the lesser understanding of the first degree of Freemasonry, we find that a lot of Freemasons associate the seven stars above the middle pillar with Pylades. Now, this, to me, is actually incorrect. The seven stars above the middle pillar, the Ionic pillar, is actually associated to Horus and the six glorious ones in the stellar mythos. And this is about the highest of the high, the one great spirit in the northern polar constellation, where they had venerated their ideas of the grand architect of the universe. Another thing I'd like to point out is in the Age of Taurus, we also give rise to the bull cults, right? Where we see a lot of sacrificial offerings being made up in the symbolic forms of blood rituals through sacrificing animals such as the bull. And we also see a lot of symbolism coming from this. A movie that comes to mind for this is the end of Apocalypse Now, where they sacrifice the bull at the end. But you have certain cults like the Minoans on the island of Crete. In the sacred Indian text Rig Veda, which is 3500 BCE, dating it back to the Taurus age, the god Sura references a solar bull who shines out through all the sky with the fire god Agni, which likened to a bull with hair on fire. Now, what I would like to say about this is a lot of these, to me, are in conjunction with death cults, because the Egyptians at this point had come out of their perfected eschatology, and the true nature cults or life cults has started to degrade, and now we're getting into the sacrifice of animals to the higher deities. So, I mean, all you got to do is take a look around you. Think about all the symbolism within your daily life that pertains to solar cult. And yes, I will be talking about the symbolism in the next section of the weapons of manipulation when we get into subversive use of symbolism. I want to give a little bit of clarity here because I had a question from a listener. They asked me what the definition of astrotheology actually is. So if you are new to the subject, and I happen to have not clarified that up to this point, the word astrotheology comes from a combination of three words. Astro, as in relating to the stars or celestial objects and their movements, frequencies, vibrations, etc. Theo, as relating to God or deities. And the suffix logi, which means the study of. This word also comes from the word logos, which means word. And that has very symbolic reference, because if you study philosophy, you should be familiar with the logos and how important that is. And of course, I will be opening that up in my philosophical discussion in the future when we start to open up the four branches of philosophy. Now, see, we have astrotheology preserved all around us. We can find it within the textual context of many ancient scriptures. But I'm going to give a really good example of this, where it is preserved in our seven-day week. The first thing that we need to understand when it comes to this is that the ancients could only see the seven celestial bodies with their naked eye. And these were represented as the seven primary deities. These were the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and the last one that they could seemingly see with their naked eyes was Saturn. Saturn represented the dark sun, or the opposing force of our sun. It is also important to note the differences between the heliocentric model and the geocentric model. The geocentric model you find often in the Christian text, where everything is circling around our planet, Earth. And the heliocentric model, obviously within the word helios, we understand that it represents the sun. So this is what we commonly know and use in our scientific methodologies, that the planets revolve around the sun. It is important to stay oriented when it comes to these things, when we are looking at the allegories and the context of the ancient scriptures and astrotheology. These were known as the seven Elohim. Elohim comes from the Hebrew Bible. It means the wanderers. So these are the seven wanderers. And I would say that they were the lowercase g gods. Okay? And it's very important to understand that. And whenever we look at ancient cultures and see things like polytheism, it is important to distinguish between the one great spirit and the archetypal celestial bodies that are representations of attributes of the one great spirit. So polytheism tends to be a way of breaking up the attributes of the one great spirit based upon characteristics and movements of these celestial bodies. So ultimately what we find is that they tend to be monotheistic, not always, but the Egyptians definitely were monotheistic, even though they may have a polytheistic system of deities. It's important to not take these literally and to understand the spiritual context in which the ancients were trying to pass down this great knowledge and science that they had discovered and preserved within many different forms of communication for us to enhance our own consciousness and create a better world with. What we're trying to do here is find the ubiquitous nature between all religions and bring them together so that we understand that they ultimately have one source. All this knowledge comes back to one source, one location, and in my point of view, it comes from Africa. And a lot of people do have issues with that because a lot of people want to contend with what modern scholars and archaeologists and, you know, anthropologists have stated about where we all come from. And I have no issue with that. What I say to that is bring on the challenge, because any type of data must be incorporated into this, and through the scientific inquiry, we will come to an understanding if we do our due diligence into that. So, back to my subject. So let's take a look at the 7-day week. Now, some of these are very, very easy to understand. We have Monday, which is Moon's Day. In the Greek mythology, the moon goddess was Selene. And one way that we can break down these days is by looking to other languages to translate their planetary word for that day. So what we have in the French language, which you can follow along with the slides, you have lundi in French, which means moon, and this is Monday. Tuesday is a little bit more complex, but it is named after the god Tu, which is spelled T-I-W. This is where we get our word Tuesday from, who was the Old English equivalent to the Roman god Mars. So in the French language, we find that Mardi also means Mars, and this is Tuesday. Wednesday is Woden's Day, Woden being the Old English name for the Norse god Odin, who the Romans considered to be the equivalent to their god Mercury. In French, this is Mercredi, which means Mercury. Thursday is Thor's Day, which should be very blunt to understand that this is the Norse god Thor, and Thor being the equivalent to the Roman god Jupiter. In French, this is Judy, which means Jupiter. And obviously, they are associated with these deities because of certain attributes. So Thor is the easiest one to associate because Jupiter is considered the god of lightning because of its great storm. And Thor is considered the god of lightning. So we could relate this back to Zeus in a certain way as well in those attributes. So one thing I would like to point out as well before I continue on is that we are looking at elemental powers here. And these elemental powers are of crucial importance to distinguish and not to be taken as physical or literal bloodlines. And a lot of people might have issues with that, but I am stating that here. These are allegorical. We should not confuse elemental powers with the perpetuation of ancestry. Friday is Freya's day, and Freya is the name for the old Norse god Frigg or Frigg, and I might be pronouncing that incorrectly as well. So just work with me with these. You're welcome to translate them yourself as well. And this is associated with the love god Frey, and this is the planet Venus. So in French, this is Vendredi, which means Venus. Now obviously, Saturday is Saturn's day. Saturn's day could be looked at as Kronos. One more thing I'd like to point out is there are many other deities that you can correlate to these planets. These are the ones that I am picking out. But obviously you can see like Thor's day is directly relevant to Thursday. Friday is directly relevant to Frey's day, etc. Tuesday is directly relevant to Tuesday. Saturday, or Saturn's day, is the god of time, and that was because it was the last planet that encompassed everything else. But we also have, in the Roman religion, Saturnus, which was another deity associated with Saturn, and has very similar attributes as Kronos. In French, this is Samedi, or Samedi, which means Saturn. Sunday is Sun's day. Obviously, it's the day of rest for all modern people because we have solar cult doctrine running amok in this world. So you go out on Friday night, you party Friday night, or you go hang out with your friends, whatever. You go out Saturday night. On Sunday, that's rest. That's the day of rest. And then you go back to your 9-to-5 job on Monday, Moon's day, to make your your money, right? So there's some correlation there to all of that. And in the Greek tradition, this is related to Helios. And in French, this translates to Dimachi. So if I brutalize those translations, I apologize. I've never been very good at pronunciation. Still working on that. But I feel that that's relevant. And this seven happens to be very important when it comes to the stellar mythos as well, because this is a solar cult overlap when we are putting a finer point on time and we are putting a finer point on the movements of the celestial bodies and the seasons and things like the vernal and autumn equinox and the summer and winter solstice. So there's a lot of things to this when it comes to understanding astrotheology. Going back to Elohim, that means gods. It's not one god. Elohim is plural for gods. I wanted to mention that earlier, and I don't think I did. El is God, and this relates back to electricity. Mag is magnetism, so we have the El and the Mag, the masculine and the feminine. And that is very important to understand. And we will explain that further in future episodes. If you're following along with the slides, the next slide is called the Age of Aquarius. Now, I have mentioned earlier that we have moved into the Age of Aquarius. Some say the Age of Aquarius is the age of knowledge, the age of washing away all of our materialistic, ego-identified illnesses. I say it's the age where humanity's ultimate goal is for freedom. So on that slide, it gives you a little bit more of an example and some numbers to work with when it comes to the great year or the Platonic year. I just wanted to mention that. The reason why I brought this up is because we are now going to focus on the age of Taurus, because I want to talk about something called the cult of Bill and Bill worship. So I'm going to end this episode with going through the next few slides, and you should follow along with them like this is a presentation if possible. Make sure to look at the visual representations that I'm giving. And I'm going to go into a little bit of green language and also a little bit of mythology to explain a few things here. And then we are going to call that the end of the method of manipulation for religion. And on the next solo show, I'll be going into subversive symbolism. So the Age of Taurus is said to be around 4000 BC to 1800 BC. Taurus is a fixed earth sign. So this is in relation to the attributes that we are assigning to these zootypes because of their time period in the seasons and how they correlate to our sacred sciences such as agriculture. And I believe I explained this before, but I will say it again. When you see the bull, you get your plows out and you start to get your gardens ready. This is what this is about. Preserving the ancient knowledge of not only the sabbatical year, which relates back to those 7 days of the week, because the sabbatical year is about the 7 years. The sabbatical year was about knowing when to not plant. So every 7 years, you have to rotate your crops because the soil becomes depleted. Thus, there is no more nutrition in the soil or nutrients in the soil. And the way that we preserve that was also in the 7 day week and in many other symbolic associations with the seven, so that we would not forget that important part of the science of agriculture. So this is about the sacred science of agriculture, because agriculture was one of the fundamental sciences that promoted healthy civilized development. It helped to evolve our species, making us less animal-like and making us be able to create less harm onto the sentient beings. And we were striving to do that. We were striving to live more in harmony with natural law because of the sacred sciences that we were developing. So it was an earth sign, obviously springtime. Obviously springtime correlates to the earth, and then when you see the bull, you would get your plows out and start to get your gardens ready and planting your seeds. So this also has a lot to do with fertility, and this correlates to the nature cults and their fertility rituals. At this time period, we have a big fertility ritual, which I'm going to talk about in just a little bit. And if you're looking at the slide, you can see that this astrological sign is associated with agriculture, money, banking, real estate, property, all matters dealing with physical ownership and permanence and security. But it goes beyond just that, because that only takes you into a materialistic view. It has a lot to do with our spiritual side. But what I mean by this is spirit in the flesh. It has a lot to do with our work being done here on the ground. So do not take this just solely as a left brain thing, because even though it is an earth sign about being fixed, it is about you bringing your spirit to the working area so that you can get the work done. So in many ancient cultures, we have the bull being symbolized by many different deities, depending on the evolution of their mythos. You must understand as well that depending on the evolutionary period of the mythos, you might find different zootypes being attributed to the same deities. So it's important to stay oriented. So at one point you might have Horus as the falcon, and another point He may be the crocodile, or he may be symbolized as a different zoo type. We find this very often. And this is because not only is the mythos evolving, but our sciences of species is starting to evolve. The characteristics of species are starting to evolve, and we're starting to put a finer point on different animal attributes and also different animals, and we're starting to distinguish one from the other. So Ra was the bull of the heavens. We have Osiris, the bull of the earth. We have Nut, the sky goddess, with the cow's ears. We have Hathor, the cow goddess in the Egyptian tradition, who is also crowned with horns. We have Bolchius, I believe that's how you pronounce that, Bolchius, which is the bull of Thebes. In addition to pharaohs, carried the Ankh, which is associated to the symbol of Venus, the planetary ruler of Taurus. Now, I want to point out here that this is later on. The Ankh is very important to understand because it's one of the first totems ever used to help the spirits go through the Duat, or the underworld. So this is one of the first types of magical tokens that the ancients would give to honor the dead and bury with their dead to help them work through the spirit realm into reincarnation. So the Ankh earlier on is, you know, symbolized by many, many different things. It's a masculine and feminine symbol being brought together. There's a lot to the Ankh. But for context of this, we do find in the later mythology and the later use of this Ankh symbol, it is associated with Venus. And since Venus is the ruler of Taurus, we have a correlation there to the bull. We have the Greeks mythology with Poseidon, who is considered the bull of the sea, the bull ravisher of Europa, who fled over the Taurus Mountains, and most notably the Minotaur, which was the offspring of Poseidon's white bull and Pasiphae. I believe that's how you pronounce that. Wife of King Minos on Crete. So we're going to talk a lot about the Minotaur here in just a moment, because it correlates to the cult of Bel. Biblical scholars also generally agree that the earliest god of the Hebrews was also a bull god. Bull shrines existed at Bethel and many other sacred locations. As I said before, the Age of Taurus replaced the Age of Aries. And Aries was, in the astro-theological sense, relating to the story of Moses, the ram god. And if anybody knows some of their biblical texts, they could readily see the connections with Moses and the ram rituals. There's a lot to the ram, and I hope to open that up in the future. Now, the next slide is called the Cult of Minerva. And the reason why I'm bringing some of this historical knowledge to the people, we need it on the table because we need to understand the ubiquitous nature between all these cults, and we need to understand how the mythos is evolving, and we need to understand how this pertains to the world that we're living in today. So Minerva is the goddess of wisdom, strategy, warfare, justice, law, victory, and a sponsor of arts, trade, and many different strategic things for the development of society. We see a lot of ubiquity here between Ma'at in the Egyptian tradition and Minerva. Men also relates back to the moon. We get this as a feminine pronunciation. Men has to do with the sacred feminine principle. So, like, we have the word menstrual, which correlates to the menstrual cycle of the female. But Minerva, in the mythology, is not a patron of violence such as Mars is, but about defensive war only. So we can find this in many different symbolic associations. The tarot is one that I think of with the Lady Justice. Now, that's not in every book. Sometimes justice is represented by a male, but Some of my favorites is when Lady Justice is represented by a female. I feel that's more pure, more in tune with the ancient Egyptian mythology, specifically going back to the goddess of justice, Ma'at. And really, we can just say that she's the goddess of natural law, the great judge of natural law. So the Romans equated her with the Greek goddess Athena. Minerva is one of the three Roman deities in the Capitoline triad, along with Jupiter and Juno. She was the virgin goddess of music, poetry, medicine, wisdom, commerce, weaving, and the crafts. And the craft is very important to understand because this is going to play along with ancient Freemasonry in the future. But obviously, you know, they're specifically talking about crafts such as music or any type of craft that you have going on at this time, which is Freemasonry. And the sacred knowledge is preserved in these crafts along with their implementations, which I will further explain in the future. And Doug may be able to really elaborate on that. This is what is very important when it comes to Minerva. She is often depicted with the sacred creature, which is an owl, which is usually called the Owl of Minerva. And this associates with her specifically to her attribute of wisdom and knowledge. But less frequently, we do see her with the snake and the olive tree. And there's a lot of symbolism behind the snake and olive tree, but I'm not going to bring that up here because we're specifically going to focus on the owl. Minerva is commonly depicted as a tall woman with an athletic and muscular build, as well as wearing armor and carrying a spear. So the reason why I'm bringing up Minerva is because we're going to talk about the Minotaur and we're going to talk about the owl. So we're going to talk about the bull and the owl. The next slide is the cult of Moloch. Moloch comes from Molech in Hebrew, which means king or ruler. The cult of Moloch directly correlates to a lot of the sacrifice rituals that are going on. This is all giving us a little bit of knowledge, the prerequisites to getting into the cult of Bill. So I'm not going to completely read all of these slides because I just don't have time to do that for this show. But you're welcome to read through them because there's a lot of extra information in there that I might skip over. So we have Moloch, which is the deity, and Molech, which is actually the ritual. So it's important to understand the difference between those two things. Some Greeks and Roman records claim that the Phoenicians of Carthage also had children that were sacrificed by fire to the deity of Saturn, Greek, which was Saturnus, or Cronus, which is the Roman god of Saturn. And this has to do with the cult of the Black Sun, and we're going to correlate all this together here, which was also known as Baal or Baal, Haman, by the Carthaginians. This is an important connection between Moloch and Baal. So we often see this, people who have studied the Illuminati and the ritual at Bohemian Grove, to see that they have a giant owl statue where they go and they sacrifice their care, and possibly even in beyond that ritual that they put on for, you know, their supporters and other people. Beyond that, I do believe they're actually symbolically and literally sacrificing real children as well. So I want to point that out, that most likely, yes, they are doing that. But as a theatrical ritual, they do what is known as the cremation of care, and they do this in front of the owl statue. We also know that they use the owl to symbolize their wisdom, right? Which they're not truly wise like we would consider them to be. But I want to connect that owl with Minerva, but also connect that with Moloch and Baal. So they're using this in a dark, perverted way because the owl is a predatory bird that preys on the innocents at night that can see 360 degrees, so it can see in the dark, so it has the knowledge within the darkness. It's something that sees in the dark, and that's how they see themselves. So the owl is a dualistic symbol. It's not just one thing. We can symbolize ourselves as the Ao as well, or attributes of ourselves. Moloch appears to have a symbolic relationship with the Ao of Minerva, as they were frequently portrayed together and share the dominion of war. This is because of the ritual called the cremation of Care, like I just mentioned, under the name of Molech, which was about the sacrifice of innocence. So this is what the Illuminati would do. They would go out, or any of these cults, when they do the cremation of Care, they go out and they ask for forgiveness for the harm that they are about to do onto the people. So they are sacrificing their care so they don't have to feel bad and feel the karmic emotional consequences of the harm that they knowingly are about to do onto the public and onto the innocents. But it's also about them sacrificing their sacred feminine principle. We obviously see that this correlates to the sacrifice of children symbolically and the sacrifice of females or virgins symbolically. Now, like I stated before, Minerva wasn't the violent god, but she got associated through the dark occult with the idea of war through this symbolism. The Ao is actually symbolism for the lunar goddess. The Ao was depicted as a symbol for wisdom because it had the ability to see in the dark full 360. This also correlates to the idea of the halo, the Christian halo, light in a 360 degree spectrum. It is a metaphor because it illuminates the darkness of the masses and educates the ignorant. This is about transcending illusion and deception and seeing the ultimate truth of the world. So you may ask, who is Bill? I keep mentioning the cult of Bill. Well, who is Bill? Bill is ultimately the one god that's ruling over this world right now. It is one of the highest religions of this world, and the majority of humankind kneels before this god. This does not particularly only associate to the house of Taurus. We need to make this very clear, but more so, this is associated to the primacy in day sky, the primacy on materialism, Darwinism, domination, slavery. Things like this. This is the primacy of control and slavery, which is associated to the day sky. And this is associated with monarchy, the one ruler, because there's only one bright light in the sky for the most part. Every once in a while, you get the moon in the sky, and I will talk about that later in the subversive symbolism section. But the light, the sun, is what gives us life, and they are claiming to be that. While most people are nitpicking over divisions of religion, they are missing the holistic picture of who rules all of the religions, which is the dark occultist or the cult of the black sun. And I would call this the solar cult that is ruling over all religions at this point. So Baal, or Baal, was ranked as the first king in hell, ruling over the east, as we can associate that to the vernal equinox. The sun rising in the eastern horizon, Horus's zone, giving birth to a new day or new year, and fertile crops for the land. And all of this has been based on that sacred science of agriculture and has been perverted down the ages. So through green language, we're going to understand a little bit more about the cult of Bill, or Baal, and the dark occultists love to use cryptic language and put it right out in front of us and mock us every day with it. So wherever you find synchronicity, make sure to pay attention to that. So Baal was one of the seven princes of hell, mainly the king of all the princes. This is drawn from the Canaanite tradition, the Hebrew Bible, as the primary god of the Phoenicians, like I said before, which they got from the ancient mythos of the solar cult of the Egyptian culture. Baal or Baal was particularly associated with storm and fertility. And as we see on this slide, you have Baal or Baal with a single-headed axe. This is so important to understand because this represents primacy in the north. I cannot put more emphasis on this. This is so important to understand when it comes to this. This represents world domination by a male left-brain patriarchal ideology. This is the gavel, and we will be speaking very deeply about the gavel. I want to briefly mention here that the Minotaur is very important to study as well, because it does have to do with what we're talking about, that we are living in a maze world, and we have to fight this Minotaur to get out of this maze, this trap that was designed to make sure to kill us, just like in the legend of the Minotaur. In the legend of the Minotaur, we have the hero Theseus, who has to come in contact with this. This is a Minoan mythology. We can take all this symbolism and correlate it on a multi-level fashion. This can also relate back to the inner parts of our body. So don't just think that this can also relate back to the inner parts of our psyche and our mind. So don't just relate this into the physical world, which we can do, but these are all archetypes of our psyche, and we need to understand them. I also want to point out here that the Minotaur wields the gavel as well, which is very important. But he has normally a double-headed axe or a double-headed hammer, and it is very symbolic. And this has to do with the ancient stellar mythos. The gavel is originally the symbol, the ancient Egyptian symbol for nature or God. And I'm not going to explain all this in this episode, but I do feel that context on that is very important, because that's a big topic to open up. But it has to do with the seven. It has to do with northern polar constellations. It has to do with the pyramid. And it has to do with the Netter, or the NTR, which is where we get our word nature from. And Doug and myself, hopefully, we will be able to open this up in the future very well. I'm sure Nate will also bring this up quite a bit. So I'm just putting it on the table, because we do need it on the table at some point. And since the symbolism is here, I am not going to ignore that symbolism. In the zodiac, or the zodiac, which means animal types, the animal circle, the circle of life, the Taurus is the bull, right? And we have the great ritual of the Illuminati that takes place at Bohemian Grove on what is known as the Gaelic holiday of Beltane. This is also known as May Day or Walpurgisnacht. There are many different names for this mid-Sabbath point, and there are four of them. But this correlates to this ritual that they do in the springtime. This is all about fertility, planting of new crops, the coming of the new harvest, which will be at the end of the year, making sure that your plants are fertile and good. When you see the Taurus, you get your ox out or your bull out, and you start to plow the garden beds, like I said before. In the markets, we have the bull market versus the bear market. And it's very important here to understand that the bull market relates to materialism and the solar cult, and the bear market relates to the stellar cult and spiritualism. The bear has a lot to do with Ursa Minor and Ursa Major, specifically Ursa Minor in the stellar cult, because it has to do with the seven pole stars, or Horus and the six glorious ones, which has to do with the gavel, nature, pantheism. And anytime we see a bull market, it's everybody going nuts over materialism. Everybody is like, yes, we're making a lot of money. And there's a decline in spiritualism, because we're putting primacy on materialism. So it's not a coincidence that you have the bull versus the bear in this. It's so important to understand how they're using these symbols to mock us, because this is a mockery of our spiritualism. Because everybody goes into depression when the bear market comes up, right? But that's because they're finally coming into contact with their true selves, and they really haven't dealt with the darkness of their own self. And they don't know how to handle that the spiritual energy that's being distracted by materialism. Now, obviously, we need a balance between both materialism, or the material and spiritual. But in correlation here to the markets, we have the bull market. We have the buy bull, which is the two bulls. So if you read that Zodiac slide about the ritual taking place during Beltane, I also gave some information about the two suns in the Hebrew tradition. But bi means two, like binary. We have two digits, zero and one. And we have two bulls. And this is about the aspects of the two suns, being the sun in the east and the sun in the west. And this correlates to the science of putting a finer point on time and the attributes that come from that finer point on time, the effects that happen during these time periods of the day. We often see this. We have Babylon, Babylon. So there's another bull in there. We have ball games, right? Everybody is out playing the ball games to Baal. We have ballers, which has to do with materialism. We have Bel, the lady that marries the beast. We have billionaires, bullionaires. We have gold bullions, and the gold represents the sun as the bull. Balkanization, Baal is in that. Baal is in that. Balkanize. And if you don't know what balkanization means, it means to take a geographical location, split it up into different regions so they all battle with each other based upon their arbitrary laws, because now you have a way of dividing and conquering that land and keeping everybody fighting with each other. We have Bolshevik. We have rebellion. And in this context, I'm saying that rebellion being used as a means of dark occult sorcery rather than the true rebellion, which you can go to my fake ass punks presentation to get what I feel is true rebellion. We have the Bilderbergs, right? Bill, we have that word Bill in there. We also have Builder in there, which has to do with masonry, the dark form of masonry. We have blockhead, block, the bullhead, right? We have bullheaded. We have bullheaded. If you're a blockhead, then nothing can penetrate you, just like if you are a bullhead. And you know that everything is all baloney. Everything is all baloney. Baal. But it's all baloney, right? Everything is baloney. Everything what we've been taught is baloney. Learn how to detect baloney and save a life that might be your own. We have belief. Bel. We also have belie in that. But Bel is in that because belief, if you believe in certain things, then belief is antithetical to knowledge. If you believe something, then you do not have true knowledge of it. You do not have gnosis of it. So those are two diametrically opposed constructs of the mind. Knowledge and belief. So Bel, and you got your head firmly placed up your rear end is where it's at, because you're bullheaded. We have lightning bolts. And trust me, we need to have lightning bolts. We need to energize our sacred masculine in the proper way. We need to be energetic in this way. We need to have boldness and the balls to say no to the corruption that's taking place. I mean, look at this grandmother or this old lady sitting in front of these immoral trash who are, you know, coming in to violently take down innocent people. And trust me, she has more balls and boldness than most men that I have ever met, ever in my entire life. We need to turn the light bulb on. We need to turn the light in ourselves on. We need to be that light, that beacon of hope for the world. We need to be the light workers. We have the Bill of Rights. And even though I am not someone who thinks that we need to have redundant authoritarian pieces of paper for our rights, because once you understand what a right actually is, it's very simple and to write it down, it becomes very repetitive and unnecessary. But we still don't want to lose any way of preserving our rights. And we have the Liberty Bell, a symbol of freedom. And look, it's cracked. I find that very symbolic that it's cracked, because our freedom is cracked. We need to be like bulldozers with the truth. We need to be unmovable bulldozers. And if it comes down to it, which I do not advocate for at this point, but if it does come down to it, you better be ready to use ballistics and bullets to get the job done. And you better be ready to use them to defend yourself and your family when it comes to it. But at this point right now, I am not in support of taking that stance yet, because I don't think that we failed yet at raising consciousness. I think we still have a chance at actually bringing this species out of this dark pit of satanic belief. I don't care if you agree with me or not on that statement. We have to strengthen our ability to stand against what's going on. We have to strengthen our mind and bring balance to the heart and the brain, and balance to the two hemispheres and the sacred masculine energy and sacred feminine energy of ourselves. We need to say no to all the lies. So we need to get away from all the bullshit. No more bullshit. And we need to hit the bull's eye. We need to hit the bull's eye of truth and morality and the manifestation of freedom by ending slavery. We need to be the light in this world. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. That's all we have time for today, folks. One thing I would like to say is make sure to do your due diligence in the astrotheology. You will not be disappointed by studying this science. I hope you found clarity and value in all the information we have been sharing here at the Cubbyhole. Please make sure to go to thecubbyhole.com for news and future updates. Also, there is another platform that you can find us on. This is called the One Great Work Network, and the website is theonegreatworknetwork.com. This is something that many great light workers have been working towards for a long time to bring to the people, where you're going to find 24 hours a day live streaming of the ancient knowledge and things like natural law. There is amazing content up there. I highly recommend that everybody go to that site immediately and check out all the great teachers on there and just start listening to the live 24/7 feed, or start going through the content creators and checking out their work. So as always, our website is thecubbyhole.com. That's CubbyWhole.com. And for now, we have one show coming out each week at 12 p.m. Pacific time. Stay tuned for more and keep transcending dogma.